Hello and welcome to Why Do We Do That? A psychology podcast that deconstructs human behavior from the perspectives of social scientists, psychologists, and others that use applied psychology in their work. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Moyer. Before I introduce my guest, I wanted to make a quick announcement. It has been almost 4 years since I launched Why Do We Do That? And all of the listener support and comments I've received over the years has been tremendously helpful. I'm very grateful to everyone who takes the time to share with me that they enjoyed an episode they've listened to. Your word of mouth makes a huge impact on downloads, so please continue to share episodes with friends, family, and coworkers. One of my passions in life is educating people about human behavior. As a full-time psychology instructor, it can be challenging to keep this train moving along. I set a very high credentialing bar when it comes to who I invite onto the show to discuss specific topics. I also prioritize making each episode both comprehensive and intellectually compelling, without making the discussion inaccessible to the average person. In honor of recording episode 50 of the podcast, I am pleased to announce that you can now become a paid supporter of the show through Patreon. For only $3 per month, you can help me grow this show to the next level. If we can generate enough financial support through Patreon, my pledge is to move permanently to 2 episodes per month and eventually weekly releases. In exchange for your support, I will offer you access to additional content, including personal video reflections about my interviews, and bonus questions and responses recorded exclusively for paid members. Supporters will receive early access to each episode before being released to the general public, and the Patreon platform will give you an opportunity to connect with others curious about human behavior. Finally, you will also have the opportunity to interact with myself in a more direct fashion. Please click on the Patreon link in the episode notes section to become a paid supporter. I'm also thrilled that I was able to book a very special guest for episode 50, world-renowned expert on the topic of play, Dr. Peter Gray. Peter is a research professor at Boston College. He has conducted and published research in neuroendocrinology, developmental psychology, anthropology, and education. His current research and writing focuses primarily on children's natural ways of learning and the lifelong value of play. He is a founding member of the nonprofit Alliance for Self-Directed Education and a founding board member of the nonprofit Let Grow, an organization which promotes childhood independence and pushes back against the model of helicopter parenting. Peter writes a popular blog for Psychology Today entitled Freedom to Learn. He is the author of the textbook Psychology, now in its 8th edition, and the book Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. My main takeaway from my conversation with Peter was that childhood play is not just for fun, but rather essential to social and emotional development. And not the type of play represented by Little League or family game night, but unstructured and unsupervised play with peers of mixed ages. While structured activities can be helpful, nothing compares to what kids learn from independently navigating the complexities of the social environment. This type of play allows children to engage in creativity, practice self-control, and discover what interests them. According to Peter, this type of play has bottomed out over the last 50 years, and it is imperative that parents proactively coordinate with their community to create environments that give kids an opportunity to experience these invaluable lessons. Also, as Peter points out, schools do not provide the type of social environment necessary to develop the key skills generated through unsupervised play. If you're struggling to comprehend the rise in mental health issues in young people, this episode will give you some perspective and tips for parents on how to structure their child's environment to foster personal growth. Enjoy. Okay, today I am joined by Peter Gray. Thank you so much for being on today. It's a real treat.
Thank you for having me on.
Peter is a psychology professor. He's an expert on the topic of play. He's also the author of a book called Free to Learn: Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. So I think it's obviously in our best interest to talk about some defining features of play. It seems as though, you know, I've also talked about play in my psychology course quite a bit. Play is not something that you can just define in one sentence. It spans a lot of different activities that children engage in, from games, sports, pretend. It seems more effective to define play in terms of features. There's some sort of descriptive elements to what play looks like. So why don't you start by giving us an overview of how we talk about play?
Play is a word like a lot of English words that people use with different meanings. And so the question is, what do I mean by play? What do most play researchers mean by play? I define play as a activity that has the following four components. So I'm going to list these components or characteristics of play. The first, and in my mind the most important, is that it is activity that is initiated, chosen, directed by the players themselves. It's not something that the players do in response to control by some authority figure outside of the play. So I would define, for example, a pickup game of baseball or basketball or soccer as play. I would not define an adult organized game for youth as play. Interestingly, there has been some research on how little children, typically kindergarten age children, define play. You show them pictures of various things or films of various things, or you ask them what play is and what's not play. And the primary defining feature to them is it's something that kids are doing themselves. If there's an adult in the picture, they tend to say it's not play, because they, even if they're doing exact same thing in the picture, if there's an adult in the picture, they're inclined to say it's not play because they make the assumption that the adult is controlling it. So this is really an important part of the defining characteristic, because I think one of the primary evolutionary functions of play is for children to learn to be independent. Play is how children take control of their own lives. It's a period of time when they take control of their own, solve their own problems, negotiate differences with their playmates, make decisions. So that's the first. The second characteristic of play, and probably equally important in terms of a defining characteristic as the first, is that it's intrinsically motivated, meaning that you're doing it for its own sake. You're not doing it for some reward outside of itself. To the degree that somebody's doing something in order to get an A on a report card or a trophy or a gold star or a praise from somebody, or to put it on the resume, to that degree, it's not play, because you're doing it for some end outside of itself rather than for its own purpose. In fact, there's research indicating that rewarding children for something that they like to do as play can actually undermine play. It turns it into something that they now define as work. Right. That in the future they're less likely to do just for fun, because now it's kind of been defined as something you do for some reward. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that play is done just because you want to do it rather than to get some tangible reward or even an intangible reward like praise is why so many adults tend to think of play as a waste of time. Why would you do something that you're not getting something for? We're so oriented towards, you know, achievement in some kind of recognized way that we tend to think, unfortunately, of play as a waste of time. But if you think about it, this aspect of play, that you're doing it just because you want to do it, wow, isn't that, shouldn't that be what life is about? Doing
right.
what you want to do, having fun. What is the purpose of life if you're not going to be able to do things just because you want to do them? But even more than that, some of my research shows that because children are doing what they want to do in play, very often they discover what they really like to do, and they become passionate about it, and they become good at it. And in for some lucky people, that becomes their career in the future. So that's one way that I think parents and teachers could understand, there is a really practical value here in doing what you want to do. It could lead to a career in the future that you really enjoy, let alone the fact that it makes you happy, which really ought to be enough. But then there's the third characteristic, which seems maybe surprising to some people, is that play is governed by rules. That play is governed by rules, which essentially are guidelines within the player's mind.
Right.
So people talk about unstructured play, and I say there's no such thing as unstructured play. Play is never random. It's always structured. You're always playing at something. And when you're playing at something, that something is the structure. You're not piling up sand randomly. You're making a sandcastle. There are rules here of what a sandcastle looks like. There's a lot of flexibility within here. There's many ways to make a sandcastle, but you're making a sandcastle.
Right.
And if you're doing it with playmates, you've agreed to make a sandcastle, and you're talking about what the rules of this sandcastle are. You're structuring the sandcastle. You're structuring your activity as you do this. So
And it's definitely internally motivated. You see kids a lot when you're playing a very unstructured game of some sort. You'll always hear kids say, "Well, you can't do that."
Exactly.
It's like, well, we didn't agree upon the rules, but there's definitely internally drawing these boundaries in their heads, right?
Well, sometimes the rules are discussed in advance, but sometimes they're just taken for granted, and sometimes they're generated as you go along, especially in social play. But you know, an example I like to give is, imagine a couple of boys engaged in what might look like the wildest kind of plays, you know, rough and tumble, play fighting. They're swinging sticks at one another. They're chasing one another around. They're pushing one another. This is the kind of play that that just looks really wild, but it's bound by rules. The difference between a play fight and a real fight is anything goes, essentially. In a real fight, you're trying to defeat the other person, you're trying to hurt the other person, you're trying to drive the other person away. In a play fight, you're trying to have fun, and to have fun, you have to keep your playmate happy. You're not trying to drive your playmate away. So that means there are certain rules about it, and the rules may or may not be stated. Normally, they're not stated unless somebody either accidentally, on purpose, violates one of the rules. You can swing the stick at somebody, hit their stick, but you can't hit them. You can push somebody down, but not on something hard. You
Right.
can hit somebody if you're the smaller of the two, but not if you're the bigger of the two, if this is an age mix game. You cannot bite, kick, scratch. And so if any of these things happen, the other one will be sure to point out, hey, you know, that they won't say that violence there, but you know, you can't do that. You do
right.
that again, and I'm out of here, no more.
Right.
So even that kind of play, which looks really wild, is actually an exercise in restraint. Children are always, they're learning to restrain themselves in a certain sense. They're learning to abide by rules. The way I like to put it sometimes is, when children decide to play, it's a free choice, but they are deliberately putting themselves into a situation where they are not completely free. They're putting themselves into a rule-bound, structured situation where they have to follow the structure unless they call time out or they quit and the game is over. So the great developmental psychologist, Russian developmental psychologist of the 1920s and early 1930s, Lev Vygotsky, he contended that in his view, the primary, the one of the major functions, I think he actually said the major function in his opinion, was that play is how children learn to follow rules, is how they learn to abide by norms, by learn how to control their behavior within socially agreed upon guidelines. In this case, the socially agreed upon is between the children. And they are learning to structure their behavior, which of course is something that all human beings have to learn. One of the difference between our species and other animals is that we always have to live according to rules and norms. We can't have a human society without people able to do that. And so children are practicing that when they're playing.
Now, do you think that if children were allowed, to, sort of have this full independent play environment where there's minimal adult intervention, do you still think that there would be children that would find that set of unspoken rules to be uncomfortable and ultimately end up opting out of play? Or is it the case that you think that opting out of play is sort of this modern development where they're sort of going into, pulling away from social interaction?
Well, I think that so. I'm not exactly sure what you're asking, but here, but I
I
might
guess
add.
to clarify better, if all the conditions are right, are all children gonna approach this interaction with other kids and eventually learn the social norms, learn how to interact with kids? Or is it the case that there are some children that are just gonna choose to opt out of this process?
This is an interesting question. So the first thing I might want to say, just to be clarify this, and I know this isn't exactly what you're asking, but I just want to make it clear that one of the primary freedoms in play is freedom to quit. You can always opt out. This is one of the differences between play and an adult structured activity where you may not feel free to opt out, but play, you can always opt out. And that's an important quality of play in terms of its educational value, because if, for example, if you and I are playing together, if we're kids playing together, and I'm a bit of a bully, and I'm telling you that exactly how you have to play, you, as a self-respecting child, are going to say, I hear my mom calling, I'm going home now. Or
Right.
you're going to be more assertive and say, if you try to boss me around like that, I'm out of here, I'm quitting. The freedom to quit is what makes play so democratic, because you've got to get consensus. Otherwise it can't happen, because the other players are going to quit. So there's a lot of negotiation about it. Now that's not quite what you're asking. You're asking, are there kids who just don't learn this, who just don't ever follow the rules? And I think there are. This is not my research, but Stuart Brown, who's one of the longtime writers on play, has done some research. He and I have a little bit disagreement about how to interpret it, very pleasant disagreement. Done some research in which he has found that people who are psychopaths, people who are considered to be psychopaths in adulthood, have no play life. They didn't play as children. His interpretation is they became psychopaths because they didn't play, My interpretation is more like they didn't play because they were
Yeah.
psychopaths. So,
Right.
you don't want to play with somebody
Who's
who
not picking up what
isn't
everyone else
willing
is
to
doing?
bend
Yeah.
and follow the rules, right? So what he found is a correlation that if you look at the play histories of serial murderers and so on, the thing that stands out is that they did not play as children. And there always have been some people who are bullies who just really never, most bullies come around but there are always some people who are bullies who don't come around. So I think it's a small percentage, but I think there may be some people who don't. There are people who take a little longer to come around, not because they're bullies or psychopaths. The kind of person who's often diagnosed these days with ADHD, the kids who are diagnosed there, it's a little harder for them to abide by the rules. they get a little distracted. They want to do things in their own way. They get and this is true in play. But my experience, because some of the places where I've observed play over a length of time, there are kids who've had that diagnosis, is they do come around, and that in fact probably the very best possible treatment for kids with this kind of diagnosis is play, because the motivation, they want to play just as much as other kids. And the motivation that comes from other kids telling them, hey, you've got to follow the rules here, or I'm not going to play with you. That's a very powerful motive. They can learn it. It's not that they're incapable of learning. It's just that they're a little bit more impulsive. Really, really, in my mind, it's a mistake to label people with as ADHD as if it's a disease. It's really a person. It's really kind of a personality characteristic. There's a kind of a continuum of impulsiveness. Boys tend to be more impulsive than girls on average, and some boys are more impulsive than others. And those who are so impulsive that they have difficulty sitting in classrooms and doing the boring work that they're required to do, they tend to get diagnosed with ADHD. But my observation is that when they are in a situation where they're more in control of their own behavior, have more opportunity to decide what they're doing themselves. They can attend to things, and they can follow directions, and they can learn to play in an ordered way.
So, what are some other cognitive or social benefits of play? Obviously, you've touched on this idea that children they learn a little bit about restraint because they have to engage in self-control in order to keep play happening, and they learn how to follow rules. What are some other
Well, so
key things that kids learn
let me go
during play?
backwards a little bit. So I said there are four characteristics. I've described three of them so far. So
Right.
let me tell you what the fourth is, and that'll also give you an idea of something else that children learn in play. So I've said that play is chosen and self-directed by the players, that it is intrinsically motivated. You're doing it for its own sake. That it is bound by rules, so you're learning to follow rules, control impulses. The fourth characteristic of play is that it is always creative. Even though there are rules, the rules are boundaries within. There's lots of room for creativity. Play is, I would say, the most creative thing that ever. It's play and creativity are in some ways almost the same thing. To be creative is to be playful in a sense, to think outside of to bring imagination into what you're doing, to play with the idea, to play with possible different ways of acting. So play is always creative, and it is usually also highly imaginative. Imagination and creativity are very similar concepts, but not exactly the same. So when children, especially young children, it's very clear that they're playing in imaginative ways. I'm pretending to be a witch or Wonder Woman or Superman or mommy in a game of house. And So they're imagining that they're a certain character, and then they're creating a scene. It's basically like improvisational acting, if adults were doing it. They're creating this imaginative scene. And in the process of this imagination, one of the most thrilling things you can do, at least it thrills me, is to watch little children play an imaginative game. And it is so incredible what they're capable of. So, you know, Piaget, the developmental psychologist Jean Piaget, argued that children are incapable of hypothetical reasoning until they're 11 or 12 years old. But 3 and 4 year olds engage in hypothetical reasoning all the time in play. So, you know, here's an example. So imagine some four and five year olds. This is a bit of a stretch for a 3 year old, but 4 and 5 year olds playing in the kitchen, and they're pretending that the kitchen table is a bridge, and somebody says there's a troll under the bridge. Well, this is hypothetical, right? There's a control under the troll under the bridge. And then somebody says, well, we better not go under the bridge. Hypothetical deductive reasoning, right? If there's a troll under the bridge, the logical consequences, we better not go. Or somebody else says, well, we better give the troll a cookie so he doesn't eat us. So children engage in this all the time. And, you know, I come to all of my research from an evolutionary perspective. And so I look at play as the way that children are designed to practice and learn all of those kinds of skills that are really important for human beings. The skill of controlling your own activity, the skill of getting along with other people, the skill of living in accordance with rules, and in this case, the skill of hypothetical deductive reasoning, which characterizes right. human beings, and as far as we can tell, no other animals. So play is, I really am not exaggerating when I say that I believe play is how children learn everything.
Right, right. I would like to talk about a specific subtype of play, often referred to as rough and tumble play. So kids love to, you know, rough house and wrestle, and, you know, especially, I mean, in my experience with my girlfriend's children, it's you know, jumping on your back and stuff like that. And it seems as though that they're is a benefit to this specific type of play. It seems as though it's something related to physicality. And it's also a type of play that you commonly see parents prohibit, you know, stop horsing around, stop wrestling and stuff like that. And it's not as though they're stopping fighting. I see parents kind of putting the brakes on, you know, rolling around and stuff like that. Could you talk about rough and tumble play, and if there's anything unique about rough and tumble play that's important for kids?
Sure. So there are two really universal varieties of play that are universal among all mammals. One is chasing play. Kids everywhere play chasing games. Tag is the universal game. So do most other mammals. They chase one another around. And the other is play wrestling, play fighting. Most mammals play fight. And the mammals that play fight the most, and where play fighting continues even on to the late juvenile stage, and for some animals even into adulthood, are those that where cooperation is most important. Play fighting promotes cooperation, opposite of fighting, cooperation. Play fighting is, in a sense, the research suggests, this isn't the only function of it, but the research suggests that play fighting is a way that, especially males, because it's more common in males, in almost all mammals, with a few exceptions, than in females, it's a means of bonding. It's a means of learning to trust one another. It's a means of saying, hey, you know, we can do this. We can be in these fighting pots. We can be swinging sticks at one another. We can be pushing one another around, and we're not hurting one another. Mm-hmm. We're controlling ourselves. I sometimes say that, this is not quite accurate, but I sometimes say that play fighting is the boys' means of hugging. It's the way of you connect. It's how you connect with somebody else. It's how you learn, this is somebody I can trust. That's not the only theory of play fighting, and I think it depends somewhat on the species that we're talking about. Play fighting can also be, for animals that are hierarchical in their organization, a way of testing one another. Where do you rank in this hierarchy? They're not really hurting one another, but they're testing one another's strengths. Now, there are some people who study play fighting, especially among somewhat older kids and in school contexts, who argue that that's a function of it there. It's kind of a way of determining status hierarchy there. That's a less ideal version of what play fighting might be doing, and I think there are disagreements of it, and I think it depends on context, and I think both of these are probably true in different situations. But certainly there's a lot of ex studies with rats and who engage play fighting is almost the only way they play, except they also chase one another around, that show that play fighting is a kind of a bonding exercise.
And
The other thing that I should say is this true for play fighting, it's true for all kinds of vigorous play that really ideally is done outdoors. Not in one of the reasons parents presumably stop it in the house is you could break things.
right.
It's really rough housing ought to be rough outdoorsing instead of rough housing. So the so but this is vigorous exercise. This is how, the play fighting, chasing, all kinds of outdoor vigorous exercise. This is how mammals, young mammals, create strong muscles, strong bones. It's also to the degree that it's a little bit frightening. It's also how you develop courage. All kinds of so-called risky play is really very important for the development of courage. It's the other interesting thing about play fighting in animals, and in my memory as a play fighter as a child, it's true for humans too, although I haven't specifically studied this myself in my observations of play. But among animals that have been studied, it's very interesting about play fighting. The preferred position is the position of being is what you would think in a real fight is the subordinate position, to be underneath the other one and struggling to get out. It's like it's practice. What so one view is this is practice in getting free from being pinned. It's practice in and it's almost like you take turns it being in the vulnerable position. So
Well, and it also makes sense that, escaping is more important than attacking. Right,
exactly.
if you
Escaping
can't
for
escape, if you can't attack effectively, you might lose, if you're hunting, you might, lose the prey, but
On this same line, think about the game of tag. The preferred position is to be the one being chased, not the one chasing. If you are caught, then the punishment is you have to be the one chasing now until you catch somebody, and then you can be the one who's chased. I've written a blog post arguing that basically all sports are versions of tag. All of our popular sports are versions of tag. And in every one of them, the preferred position is being chased. The quarterback who's being chased, who, you want to be the quarterback because people are chasing after you. They're trying to tackle you. They're trying to get you. That's thrilling. You don't want to be the one who has to do the tackling. That's just a boring kind of job, right? So isn't it interesting that our sports are really derived from tag? And when animals are studied, the same thing is true. What you'll see among, let's say, young foxes is one fox cub will run up to another one and nudge him, provoke him, and then run away. You know, you can imagine the smile on that fox's face as the other one now chases him, and then the other one catches him, and then that one runs away. They're basically playing tag, and they are practicing escaping. Or think of, you know, there's if you have a if you if you're have a toddler in your life or a little child in your life, and you want to get a real laugh out of them, pretend you're a monster chasing them, and you're going to eat them up for breakfast. In a dream or in real life, this would be the worst possible experience you can imagine. But in play, it's the most enjoyable, thrilling experience for kids. And so it's so play is one of the great purposes of play, is to learn how to get away from predators. We were preyed upon throughout our history by animals, but we were also preyed upon by other people. And how to get away from, how to get away, how to get away, how to escape.
So, knowing all of these benefits and what play can do in terms of social or cognitive development, you've spent a large portion of the last decade or so talking about how play has declined, specifically in American culture, but I'm sure in other cultures you probably see similar types of declines. And you argue that there's some in your book and in a lot of videos you've put out that there are some major negative outcomes that have occurred from this decline in play. Obviously, it seems to be a combination of home life and school life that has changed fundamentally. What would you put at the top of the list for explaining why we see such a dramatic decline in certain types of play?
Yeah, I'm not sure which I would put first, but the three top that I would put, and maybe in order of their occurrence. The first is the development of the belief that children are at risk if they're not being supervised and directed all the time. Initially this was kind of understood that the biggest change began to occur in the 1980s, and in 1979 there was a case of a young boy snatched away on the street and murdered, a 6-year-old boy. And of course it was all in all the news. It was everybody heard about this. And then in 1981, a similar thing happened with another boy snatched away and murdered. Now, these are two cases out of millions and millions of children, right? But precisely because it's such a rare thing, it made big news and everybody heard about it. And one of the families, quite understandably, if I were in that situation, I might, in order to try to have some positive outcome, or what I believed would be a positive outcome of this, I might have done the same thing, made a big issue out of this in terms of the idea, and trying to promote legislation, trying to promote advertisement campaigns to parents, letting them know that it is really not safe to allow your child outdoors because something like this could happen. There was also, and if my memory is right, this was in the 1980s too, beginning maybe mid-1980s or towards the 1990s, you would see on milk cartons, you'd be eating your breakfast, and the milk carton would show pictures of missing children. What wasn't pointed out is, in fact, probably wasn't even known at the time, but somebody went back and did a study of those missing children pictured on milk cartons, and almost all of them were runaways. They weren't people who were snatched away on the street. Or if they, the other thing that we know is when children are snatched away, it's you know, 99 times out of 100, it's not a stranger on the street. It's somebody you know very well. It's it's your ex-spouse or your grandparents who don't think you're raising the child right, or your parents who don't think you're raising the child right, or somebody else who believes that this is their child or not your child. We also began to get frightened about sexual molestation of children, and again by strangers. But the reality is that sexual molestation by a stranger is very rare, always has been very rare. Sexual molestation by somebody you know is not rare, not that rare. Sexual molestation by that uncle or that well, as we know, by that priest, at least over a period of time, or a teacher or a coach. These are where sexual molestation is way more likely to occur. Somebody who knows the child well, has a relationship with the child well, and we should be concerned about sexual molestation, but it's misplaced to believe that it's primarily strangers on the street that we have to be worried about. I mean, as somebody said, I would hope tongue in cheek, that your kid is safer on the street than they are in church or in school or in your brother's home. I wouldn't push that too far, but the just the end result of that is that it began the idea spread that if you are a conscientious parent, you are going to be watching your child all the time. So the old idea, which, when I was a kid, and even when my own son was a kid in the 1970s, I was a kid in the 1950s, my son was a kid in the 90s, you would just send the kid outdoors, get out of the house. Every parent wanted their kids out of the house. And since everybody else is sending their kids out of the house, you go out of the house, there's a lot of kids. So there are always kids to play with. And that, in fact, is a, I would argue, a normal human environment for children. That has been the norm, as far as I can tell, throughout human history. That's the norm in all non-Western cultures. Children are spending huge amounts of time away from adults with other children. They're growing up with other children more so than with adults. And so this has been something really unique in human history, where children are deprived of living with, of experiences with other children without other adults around. So that's one thing that happened. The other thing, another, a second thing that happened is that schools became more stress-inducing, more time-consuming. When I was in elementary school in the 1950s, there was no homework for elementary school. Not only, there might have been, I recall teachers would sometimes ask us to write a poem at home or a little short story and bring it in to share, something fun like that. But we never carried worksheets home. We never carried lug books back and forth between home. There was no expectation that we're supposed to be doing school at home, and our parents were supposed to be monitoring that, and they were supposed to be assistant teachers. So this invasion of schooling into the home greatly changed the nature of parent-child interactions. It used to be enough to be a parent that you fed your child, you loved your child, you comforted your child, and you had your child do chores. Your child was also helpful to you. But now you're supposed to be a teacher to your child. You're supposed to be doing all these other things. You're supposed to be enriching your child's experiences. So the home becomes kind of an extension of school. And then, as part of this, parents who get this idea they're supposed to be enriching their child, instead of just sending their child out to play, and they don't recognize that that's enrichment, they think that putting the child in some other adult-directed activities, it has some kind of adult-directed goal. It could be music lessons, but it could also be adult-directed sports, where the adults are actually teaching you how to play the game supposedly correctly. And I think some parents even have a fantasy that their kid will get good at it and get a scholarship to college ultimately, So that happens as and basically, so that's part of what has happened. School itself, besides taking up more time, became more stress-inducing because we began, it used to be Getting a C is fine. That's normal.
Right.
Parents didn't sweat it that much. I think there's another thing that happened in the 1980s, and I hope I'm not going to be politically offensive here to anybody, but what happened in 1980 is Ronald Reagan was elected president. And Ronald with Ronald Reagan and with the Congress that he had to work with, we changed the economic situation in America. Up until 1980, there was not a huge gap. There was a big gap, but not an enormous gap between the rich and the poor. You could be working class. You could have a union job and make a decent living. I look at my own stepfather, I look at my uncles, they were all union men, they were all working class. They could, and this was a time when wives typically did not work. You could be working at a factory, you could be working as a carpenter, you could be working as a plumber, and you could make enough money to own a house, to own a cottage in the country, and to raise your family. And the unions were destroyed, more or less, which really changed that. And the tax structure was dramatically changed. And when the tax structure was dramatically changed, the rich got richer and the poor did not get richer. I don't know if they got poorer overall, but some of them did. So the result of this is that parents began to get much more concerned about their children's future than they were before.
Right. And
And they
status.
began to become really concerned that their children go to college. In the past, you could make a living without going to college. And there wasn't, going to college was something you did if we're going to be a professor or certain kinds of things, but there what you didn't have you know, there wasn't the expectation that you had to go to college to have a good life.
Well, and the irony now is that there's because we have these blinders on towards a college education, and I mean, I'll preface this by saying I've spent most of my entire life in academia, but we have such hyper focus on college that we are shifting towards producing 21-year-olds out of college with a degree, a piece of paper, and a little bit of education, depending on their major, but not a lot of practical skills, they don't have the competency in something that is immediately valuable. And it's sad because, this is what the trade alternatives offer, and no one really wants to put that at the top of the as an option competing with college.
Exactly. And I think precisely for that reason, I think the tide is changing a little bit in recent years. I think that there are somewhat fewer people oriented towards college, particularly among males. And I think it's because there's a recognition that there are well-paying jobs out there that don't require a college degree. These are not. So, I had said that you could be a plumber and so on, but you could still be a plumber today and make good money. You could be an electrician today and make good money. You can get a, you know, you don't need a bachelor's degree to do these kinds of things. And these are jobs that can't be shipped off to China, and you don't develop a big debt to get yourself prepared to be able to do these kinds of jobs. So this shift, the other thing that occurs, the in a sense, once we have so many people going to college becomes what high school used to be, right?
Right.
In some sense, the function of the educational system, there will be people who will be angry about my saying this perhaps, but the some sense the function of the educational system is not to educate but to discriminate. It's to decide who are now going to be the elites. And there was a time at one point where a high school diploma was good enough. It put you in that category. You made it through that. Well, you had whatever it took to get that high school diploma, so you're valued as an employee. But as soon as everybody was getting high school diplomas, the high school diploma got cheapened. And now, and I think a similar thing is happening with college. As soon as everybody's, if everybody were going to college, if we had universal college, everybody went to college, it would cheapen it. It wouldn't have that selective value anymore. You don't learn a heck of a lot in college. That's been proven over and over again. But it's that selective quality. It's the fact that you are a college graduate. And so recruiters come and look at you more than they would if you weren't. That's been the value of it. But I think more and more businesses are recognizing that the college graduates don't actually know that much because of college. Certainly not that much that has to do with their job. And so we're beginning to see, interestingly, a revival of apprenticeships. We're beginning to see some companies who are changing their hiring policies so that they would rather hire somebody right out of high school who is eager, who will work for less pay, but who will work themselves up and maybe be in an apprenticeship program than somebody out of college. This is beginning to happen.
So let's zoom into the elementary, middle school environment and look at how they address play. I mean, schools do make an attempt to give children they create recess time. It's that amount of time has probably shrunk over the last few decades. Is there anything wrong with how schools implement play?
Well, first of all, you're right, the recess has shrunk, and it is really shrunk. So let me give you an example. Now, when I was in elementary school, I remember this very well for fifth and sixth grade. We had 6-hour school days, but 2 of those hours were outdoors playing. We had half an hour recess in the middle of the morning, half an hour recess in the middle of the afternoon. We had a full hour of lunch. Some kids went home for lunch in those days, but most of us brought a bag lunch, ate it in 5 minutes, and spent the rest of the time playing. And recess and lunch hour were real free play, as I don't even remember teachers watching us. They may have been watching us. But we played in real ways. This was in northern Minnesota. We made snowball forts. We had snowball fights. We, in the fall and spring, we played games with knives, believe it or not. We did all kinds of things that would get you expelled from school today. But this was no real play. We did rough and tumble play. I remember in third grade, there was a big hill behind the school, and we had this basic game that a lot of the boys were playing and of kind of king of the hill. Who could wrestle the other one down the hill? And then you would go up, and then somebody else would challenge you to wrestle them down the hill. You know, we played those. We played a lot of really vigorous games, and it was real play. What you have, let me contrast that now to the elementary schools in Boston. They have 15 minutes a day. That's it. 15 minutes of recess in elementary school. This in my mind, is child abuse. 15 minutes, hardly enough time to get out and get back in at least in many schools, on a paved playground with a fence around it. It looks like a prison yard. And with people there and the teacher there telling them, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. This is not play. So the recess has been more or less destroyed. There's some recognition by some schools aiming to bring it back to some degree. But play really doesn't occur at school as it used to. The other thing I want to say about school, because school is the other thing, big thing that is the cause of the mental health crisis. I'll give you an example. There are several studies that I can refer to that show that the biggest cause of young people's anxiety today is school. It shouldn't be surprising to us when we realize the stakes that are presented to children that they believe. These are somewhat myths, but they believe it. Parents believe it. Kids believe it. So I'll give you an example of some studies. So the American Psychological Association every year does a study called Stress in America, where they survey Americans, and usually they only include adults in this study to determine how stressed they are and what's stressing them out. But in 2014, they decided for that year to include teenagers, adolescents in school. They found out that the adolescents, by the index they were using, were the most stressed out in America, people in America, more so than adults. And when they asked them, what is the cause of your stress? Now, you could give more than one answer, but among the answers, 83% included school in their answer. It was far and away the most often stated answer. Second most often stated was concern about getting into college, concern about about my future job. Something like 40% mentioned that. This ought to be on the front page of every newspaper. We ought to all know this. This was suppressed even by the American Psychological, you know, it's in the data, but it's not something they have publicized largely. Now let me describe a couple of other studies. The rates of suicide among school-aged children, especially teenagers, but sometimes even younger than that, have skyrocketed over time. What's interesting, and we have the data going back for about 10 years or more, that at least in these recent years, the rate of suicide among school-aged children is twice as high when school is in session than during the summer when school is not in session. There are similar studies showing the rates of pediatric mental health admissions, emergency admissions for breakdowns, plummets in the summer compared to the school year. The rates are highest during those times of the school year when kids are getting exams. Interestingly, everybody talks about how stressful COVID was for children. The fact of the matter is the rate of suicide plummeted during COVID. It went down. And there's now a study that shows it stayed down until schools were in in-person session again. And in fact, since different school districts became in-person in session at different times, these people actually charted it, showing that when the suicide rate increased in any given area correlated with when schools were in session again. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, somebody shows a tiny correlation between social media use and anxiety, and that makes headlines or gets an article in the Atlantic magazine. Nobody knows about it. It doesn't get reported.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk a lot about some solutions for schooling. You talk about some different models to approach schooling. You talk about unschooling. I definitely recommend that people pick up your book to explore those in detail. As we wrap up, though, I want to circle back for parents. You know, in your book, you talk about how this degradation of neighborhoods where people have these shared spaces and kids can play with other kids of different ages, that these spaces have declined. And in your book, you give tips on how parents can kind of focus on creating a better neighborhood, a more interconnected neighborhood, an opportunity for kids to play. And I'm curious as to what parents can do in conjunction with that in order to just encourage a playful mindset.
Yeah, so I often, when I talk with parents and parents groups, I often say this in my mind is the biggest challenge of being a parent today, is how is it that you can connect your kid, if you could find a way for your kid to connect with other kids without you being there. You know, your parents are always getting advice about what they should, why they should be there and be doing things directly for their kid. I want to say the difficult thing is getting your kid away from you with other kids and also away from other parents who are going to tell them what to do. This is not an easy task in today's world. So I think that there are some things that can be done. But it's initiative. It doesn't just happen easily. So there are some parents in some neighborhoods, because they recognize this is really important. And there are often parents who valued their own freedom in childhood, who remember being more free in childhood and playing independently of parents. And there are fewer and fewer parents for whom that's the case as time goes on, because this has been a problem for a few decades now. But some parents have done this, and what they do is they get together with other parents in the neighborhood. This is one of the things we don't, you know, we live kind of in isolated nuclear homes more than we used to. Parents used to be outdoors more often too, and they'd get to know the neighbors, and they'd get to know the neighbors through the kids. And so you began to trust the neighborhood because you knew that your next door neighbor, lo and behold, he's not a child molester. and you got to know the other kids and the other parents, and so it seemed safe to play in the neighborhood, and everybody send their kids out to play in the neighborhood. But now parents don't know their neighbors, and they don't, and the kids don't know the kids next door because everybody's inside all the time. So one thing you can do is maybe you hold a block party or larger party or neighborhood party, or maybe you just make a point of you know, whether you knock on the neighbor's door, you somehow get to know them, and you talk with them about play. You know, wouldn't it be great if our kids could play outdoors more and play the way kids used to play? Do you remember playing this way? And maybe they'd, you know, here's a little plug, maybe they'd even give them my book about how valuable play is, or they'd give them a little article or some. We're actually now creating a little flyer that is primarily for pediatricians to give to parents about the value of play and why and what play is and so on. So maybe they do that, but the ones who are doing it now, somehow they get together with other parents and they say, so let's figure out a way that we all feel would be safe enough, and we'll be like old-fashioned parents, we'll just all send our kids out at the same time. Maybe at certain hours on the weekend, certain days after school, we'll just all send our kids out. And if there are people concerned about safety, maybe they're concerned because there's traffic on the street, or maybe there are still people concerned about strangers or something like that, or in some neighborhoods, quite legitimately, where this has been done, people are concerned about drug pushers. And so, because this has been done in some housing projects in areas in areas that truly are dangerous in some ways. So for safety purposes, let's have an adult out there who's there just for safety purposes, but who doesn't intervene, doesn't, you know, is kind of invisible to the kids, except is just there to make sure that nothing really dangerous happens. And so there are families that, there are some places that have done that, and with considerable success. So that can be done. It takes initiative, and you have to convince your neighbors to do this. But that's one route. Another thing that I suggest to parents, this isn't a total solution by any means, but when you go on a family vacation, how about going with other families? How about going with a group of families who all have kids? And go to some place where there's place, maybe you go to a campground, or you go to some place where there's lots of place to play, and the kids can play. They can run off and play. You don't have to mind your kids now all the time. They're off playing with other kids, and you can be socializing with the other parents. You can do adult things, and the kids can do kid things. My belief is that everybody has a better vacation as a result of that. Sometimes you don't, sometimes you want to get away from your kids, and your kids definitely want to get away from you sometimes. So that's another thing to keep. Or go to a family camp where there are family camps where there are whole families there, and there's the kids have playtime and things they can do away from parents. Then the other thing, and this is something that I'm involved in, I helped, along with Lenore Scanese, who wrote the book Free Range Kids, and a couple of other people, we started an organization called Let Grow. We are working with advising parents in various ways, but we're also working with schools to bring real play into schools. And very often, parents can play a role in this work with schools, because if parents lobby the school for it, the school is far more likely to do it. What we've done in schools is to bring play not as recess during school hours. We haven't been able to get schools to allot much more time, to take away more time from test preparation, which unfortunately they're so obsessed with. But rather to have free play available either before school or after school. Now, and the way this is done, Play Club, I actually sort of created this and defined the boundaries of it. It's at least an hour of free age mixed play where all the kids in the school are free to play. So it typically is elementary school. So it's kids from age five, kindergarten age, on through about 11, sixth grade, fifth grade age. And they're all playing together. Age mixed play, by the way, I've studied, is in many ways more valuable than age segregated play. It's more creative. It's more nurturing. There's less likely to be bullying going on than in same age play. And also you have a bigger variety of playmates. And so this is play that it takes place in the outdoor playground and in the gymnasium and in the hallways between the gym and the outdoor playground. And for some schools, the art room is set up. You can use art supplies to play. You have some rooms have games in them or puzzles. If you want to play in those ways. So there's a whole different, lot of different ways to play. There's loose parts, there's hula hoops, there's basketballs, there's soccer balls, there's all kinds of things you can play with and all kinds of people you can play with. And most schools who have adopted this so far are doing it only 1 hour a week, but the kids, far and away, this is their best hour of the week. They love it. But even more than that, beyond that, the teachers are beginning to love what's happening, what they see is happening. The parents are beginning to love it. I was worried about schools that were doing it before school rather than after school, which turns out to be the majority of schools, because I thought kids aren't going to want to get up early to go to school, even for play. But it turns out I was wrong about that. They do want to get up early to go for play. So we've heard from parents, our surveys. My kid says, be sure and get me up early. Tomorrow is play club day. So they are so eager to go. And the schools have reported that the whole atmosphere, the climate of the school is better because everybody feels a little more playful about it. The teachers who monitor Play Club are told that their job while monitoring Play Club is not to tell the children how to play, not to direct the play, not to solve little problems, not to worry about little squabbles that occur. They're there to be like a lifeguard on an ocean beach. If there's real danger, then step in, but otherwise let the kids solve the problem. A major purpose of play is for children to learn to solve their own problems. And what we hear from the teachers is that they have been impressed that they don't have to step in. They've been impressed how little, if any, times they ever have to step in. They're also told, You're not there to be a recipient of tattling either. So if people come and start tattling, instead of you stepping in and trying to solve the problem, deflect it in some way by saying, "Oh, that's interesting. So what might you do about it?" Turn it back over to them. Johnny is bothering me. He won't play the way I want to play. And so, oh, so what might you do about it? Well, maybe I'll go play with somebody else. Oh, that's a good idea.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. I will give you, I'll mention the site again. It's letgrow.org, I believe. You are not the first person to mention that. I believe one of my earlier guests, Camilo Ortiz, mentioned letgrow.org. I highly recommend going to listen to that episode of this podcast if you have time. We have run out of time. Thank you so much for being on. It's been an absolute pleasure, Peter Gray.
Thank you.
For more on Peter, visit his Substack at petergray.substack.com. That's PETERGRAY.substack.com. Or check out his book, Free to Learn: Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life, wherever books are sold. If you enjoy this podcast, please share an episode with two of your friends. Head over to Patreon to become a paid supporter of the show. Follow the Why Do We Do That Facebook page for additional content. Don't forget to rate and write a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow on Instagram at Why Do We Do That Podcast or Twitter at WDWDTPod. As always, feel free to email me with comments or guest suggestions at whydowedothatpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Dr. Ryan Moyer, hoping you found some answers to the question, why do we do that?